Hello, welcome to season three of Our Bodies, Our Stories.
We are so excited to be back, and we hope you are too.
We have some really cool topics lined up for the season, so stay tuned.
But today, we're going to be addressing something super important that we both feel is often overlooked when it comes to conversations about abortion.
Mental health. Mental health is something that's just undermined in this country, not just with regards to abortion, but as a whole. It is underfunded, undersupplied, and expensive. This makes access to mental health services a privilege when it should be a right.
Exactly. Mental health is so important, and we need to be talking about it a lot more. So that is why today we are so excited to have with us renowned psychiatrist Dr. Shefali Batra, who is going to help us understand the dangers that a lack of abortion access pose to mental health.
Hello, Dr. Shefali. Welcome to Our Bodies, Our Stories. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. It's wonderful to be here with you guys.
Yes, and it is such an honor. Dr. Shefali Batra is a psychiatrist and life coach who is also the author of the recently released book, Why Do I Feel So Sad? She spends her time between the United States and India, and her efforts are consistently focused on destigmatizing mental health concerns and enabling people to seek help to become the happiest and most content versions of themselves.
We're so happy to have her on this episode of Our Bodies, Our Stories. We also wanted to use this opportunity to help us address another important facet of mental health care with a more specific focus on the mental health within AAPI communities.
As a South Asian, Dr. Batra moved to the United States around a decade ago, and we're super excited to have an AAPI lens for this discussion.
Before we begin, we want to provide a content warning for this episode. This episode touches upon sexual violence. We understand that this may be triggering to some listeners, so feel free to skip this episode if you need to.
All right, and for the first question for Dr. Batra, in previous episodes of Our Bodies, Our Stories, we've talked about how the lack of abortion access affects everyone, and we've also touched upon the greater societal impact of not having a safe or, in fact, any access to abortion. So, as a psychiatrist, do you believe there are some ways in which the overturn of Roe affects mental health specifically?
Honestly, with the overturn of Roe, there is this newfound stress of worrying about what to do with an unwanted pregnancy, especially for those living in states that restrict abortion access. If you think about it, carrying an unwanted pregnancy is not just a question of 9 months, it's about a lifetime. And the consequences for a mother's physical as well as mental health really, really go up because of the unwanted aspect. Well, pregnancy, anyways, is a physical stressor, but when it's unwanted, these risks are highly increased. I mean, there's definitely going to be an uptick in depression and shame and probably self-harm. Secret keeping, the whole stigma attached to it. And this leads to a lot of hopelessness and despair and even anxiety. You know, that's what happens when you don't have bodily autonomy. I mean, forced pregnancy is a mental health risk as well as a very big stressor. In fact, I was looking up and, you know, been reading about it. Studies show that when abortion is not available to women as a reproductive health care option, there is an increased likelihood even for violence, you know, which could be perpetrated by parents or their partners and even siblings and members of community. So it's not just the woman who's going through it. It's even people around who know that this was unwanted. This was something she didn't want, and even people around don't want. So it just makes it a lot harder, you know, and there could be depressed women who wouldn't even want to step out of the house because they're not feeling good about their pregnancy. Imagine that such a woman wouldn't even be able to get out of the house for doing her checkups because she wouldn't feel like. So for a lifetime, this struggle with the awareness that she didn't have right to her own body, you know, and to think that some politicians decided what she can and cannot do with her body is just very, very distressing.
Yeah, I agree. It's not just the idea of having a child inside of you for 9 months, but the fact that you didn't have a choice
It
in the
just goes
matter.
so much beyond, yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that there's no decision, and especially like you said, it's not just like the 9 months, it's the lifetime. Because even if let's say this person gives up the born child for adoption, maybe, or they do a closed adoption or something like that, even then, you never forget the experience and you carry
absolutely
that with you for
the rest of your pregnancy
life.
Is known as one of those life-changing experiences when you have someone growing inside of you. And imagine not wanting that, not wanting you. People don't even call it a child. They say, I don't want this. I don't want it to be growing inside me, because it becomes more of a reminder than an actual person, which is unfair to both, to be honest.
I agree. And we also, so there have been a lot of cases where to get an abortion in a state where it's banned, people have resorted to unsafe methods or just performing the abortion by themselves at home. In what right. ways would you say this is dangerous?
You know, it's so ironic that comprehensive abortion care is actually included in the list of essential healthcare services. You know, this was published by the World Health Organization in 2020, which is just so recent. And abortion is such a simple healthcare intervention that can be effectively managed by a range of healthcare workers, you know, using medical or surgical procedures. But yet it has reached a stage where people have to use unsafe methods, and because everyone's not a professional. So, you know, some of the physical dangers of abortion, which is carried out in a non-professional setting, could be, you know, point number one is the whole incomplete abortion, wherein there's a failure to expel the entire pregnancy tissue from the uterus, and which could lead to infection. Then there are chances of hemorrhage, which means excessive heavy bleeding, which could even take away one's life. As I mentioned, you know, the chance of infection by inserting unsafe, unhealthy objects within the vagina and the uterus. You know, there are chances of uterine perforation when you pierce it with a sharp object. And definitely damage to the genital tract and internal organs because of inserting dangerous objects, you know, through the vagina or the anus. That's what women have known to do. But more than that, you know, we even have psychological effects, like, you know, the whole stress and the uncertainty. Will this be a completed procedure? The fact that I had to actually do this by myself, or I was alone, you know, so the discriminatory stigma. Then we have the financial burden if you really have to travel to another state, you know, so that's not easy for a lot of people. You know, there is the whole vast majority of the population who cannot afford to do this. And, you know, they travel to an unusual place, an unsafe place, the whole financial cost, which gets to them. So unsafe methods basically violate human rights of women and girls, including the right to life, the right to highest attainable standard of physical and mental health, the right to benefit from scientific progress and its realization. You know, as personally as a doctor, you know, even though I'm a psychiatrist, I have, during my training days, we've actually done abortion procedures. We've actually delivered babies as part of our undergrad medical curriculum in India. And we learned that it's, even at, when we become doctors, we want to give the best service to our patients. And to think that a procedure like this would have to be done by the self, you know, it really takes away the right to decide freely and responsibly, you know, your number, your spacing and timing of your children, and the right to be free from torture, I would call it. You know, it's, this is cruel and it's inhuman. It's as if like a degrading form of punishment. So I just think it is so wrong at so many levels.
Yeah, and a medical procedure should be between a doctor and their patient. There shouldn't be other people.
Professional, yes. Yeah. And to think that this was a process, it was a procedure, and now it has been deemed wrong. It is so wrong to make a medical procedure wrong.
Yeah, and forced pregnancy, which banning abortions could be reframed as a lot of times forcing someone to be pregnant, is actually a war crime.
Absolutely. It's a form of torture to make someone go through that.
I hate that this is like the state that we are in at this point, where we are getting to where war crimes are commonplace.
You know, something is according to me, morally, ethically, and in every way wrong to inflict on a person. It's punishment for something you didn't really do anything wrong. And we're actually talking in cases of, especially look at rape. If a woman has to go through that kind of torture, and then she has to go through the torture of bearing that child and raising him or her for the rest of her life, I mean, how is it even fair?
It's not. It's not at all. And sort of circling back to one of the things you said earlier, just sort of about transgender individuals. So, and just another important aspect of mental health and abortion that Sina and I wanted to touch on was just gender dysphoria. So in the case that a trans man is pregnant and needs an abortion, so not having one could trigger some severe gender dysphoria.
Absolutely. Because, you know, especially abortion restrictions are going to affect transgender men and non-binary people, you know, who get pregnant. It's going to affect them very significantly, because for many trans people, getting an abortion is already a challenge, even without the restrictions. In fact, there was a study in 2021 in the journal BMJ Sexual and Reproductive Health, where they surveyed trans, non-binary, and gender expansive people in the United States. And of the 210 respondents who had ever been pregnant, about 1 in 5 said that they had attempted to end their pregnancies without clinical supervision, even without a law like that. So imagine that, you know, that number, by the way, is about 3 times higher than the rate of otherwise self-managed abortions amongst women in the US. So when it comes to abortion, trans people are just left out of the conversation, which means that the impact for them is going to be even more significant. You know, the discrimination that they actually face in their daily lives, and the stigma around being pregnant, a transgender person, it could, everything from their safety to financial stability, jobs, and their mental and physical health, it's really possible that many of them would be severely depressed and probably be driven to suicide.
Yeah, and there's some pro-abortion movements that just refer to people that need abortion as women. And I think this is so problematic, because that's not reproductive justice. That's pro-abortion, but it's not pro-reproductive rights, when you're completely writing a whole group of people out of the conversation.
Absolutely. It's like, what world do they even live in, or where do they even go? Because there's no one to understand or empathize with them. We're getting to the point of recognition of the communities, but to actually go on to think about the medical acceptance, and then to think about abortion and how the whole pregnancy would affect their identity, but I don't think anyone's really empathizing or understanding what they might be going through.
Yeah. And just circling back to what you said about rape resulting in pregnancy, in cases of sexual violence, when someone needs to have an abortion, it can be extremely disturbing, not just to go through the pregnancy, but to bring someone else into the world when you're in so much pain. Could you shed some light on both the impacts on the birthing person, as well as a more long-term generational impact on the child that has been born as a result of sexual violence?
Absolutely. You know, at an individual level, victims of rape and sexual violence endure physical consequences like genital injury and, you know, even sexually transmitted diseases, which include HIV/AIDS, which are very traumatizing. And coming to the psychosocial consequences for the mother, at a meso level, you know, we look at stigmatization, ostracization, community rejection, and spousal abandonment, which puts them at a risk for depression. And worse still, with maternal depression, it is so much harder for mother and child to attach, which in turn causes emotional and learning difficulties for the child later on in life. These kids could become targets of ridicule and abuse. They could have issues with the formulation of mature identity, as they are ridiculed for not having a father, as well as accused of a diminished heritage of the mother. So this child might be a reminder for the trauma that the woman endured. Imagine going through that for all your life. You know, these kids never get the right opportunities and the space in society. It enhances their chances of becoming victims, or probably they would become perpetrators of crime. And this becomes a never-ending cycle. And we don't want that. But imagine that child. You're literally born an orphan with parents, despite having parents. And that's not a healthy upbringing, even for that child to know how he was born. And I'm not sure if the mother would be very maternalistic towards this child. So you grow up with that rejection, which has very serious psychological consequences. Sometimes, like I said, the internalizing reaction would be to be depressed, but the externalizing reaction would be to take revenge from the world. And who knows, such a child could become a perpetrator of sexual violence on others. It's not something we want or need in the world today.
And so that sort of brings us to our next question, talking about Roe v. Wade. So in the face of Roe being overturned, and with the constant anti-trans and anti-2S LGBTQIA plus bills being passed, people are consistently distressed, and rightfully so. And so there's a quote by Audre Lorde where she says, quote, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare," unquote. So my question for you, Dr. Batra, is what can people do to take care of their mental health in the face of threats to their reproductive rights and autonomy? Are there specific mental health resources or strategies that might be particularly helpful for people experiencing distress related to this? Or basically, how can people cope?
Truly, you know, restricting abortion legally has definitely had disproportionately negative outcomes amongst individuals, especially of the lower socioeconomic status, as well as the marginalized communities, especially in the medically underserved areas. So, you know, women of color and LGBTQ communities, they may not be as able, you know, to buy a plane ticket and pay for hotels in a state that's allowing abortion. And, you know, this puts them in a constant state of stress, as you mentioned, the whole idea about mental distress. So, you know, the question, what if, you know, keeps looming in the mind, and that enhances the stigma because illegal turns into immoral. And when you internalize things like that, you know, it becomes hard. So I think it's very important to normalize and validate these feelings. You know, a law is passed by a handful of people, but there is the entire community around there who may be unhappy about it. Like personally, I am unhappy about the law, you know, so it's at one end, you're just wishing that this is overturned and we're back to getting our freedom and reproductive rights back. But while this is going on, I would say it's important to slow down and check with yourself. You know, how are you feeling? Ask yourself these questions. How am I feeling? What am I needing? Simple questions like, have I had enough food and water? Did I exercise? Did I scroll social media feeds for hours to see what's happening about the law and how people are thinking? You know, I think it's very important to be gentle with yourself, meet your basic needs, and please keep doing things that bring you happiness and peace, because despite what is happening, we still have a life around us. And I think it's very important to live that life fully. So spend time doing what you like, be in nature, meditate, connect with your inner self. And importantly, go to a safe place, a friend, a colleague, a family member, be with a social group, community meeting, or seek therapy from a professional. You know, keep that hope, keep the faith. There will be a change. You know, you might think right now that you're stuck in the chaos, but it's a very important time, I think, for people to lean on one another, because there's even this branch of therapy called ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, wherein we're going through something and we know that change may not be possible right away, but we accept what's going on around us and commit ourselves to take care of ourselves and get a way out of this despite what's happening around, because that's what is more important. You know, it's not even that all the women out there are pregnant and wanting an abortion, but the fact that the stress that could build up, you know, imagine a newly married couple and they aren't ready or thinking about a child right now. And they might just think of not being intimate because what if I get pregnant? And that could mean so much for someone who's studying, trying to build a career, make their life. And so that adds a lot of stress. So I would say work on a way to lower your stress and there will be a way out. You know, there will be some way to reach a space of peace and calm. But until then, we'll have to hang tight and do the things that make us feel better.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And if you have time, I also wanted to ask you about your experiences living in the US as a South Asian woman. Do you have any specific stories or tips for AAPI individuals to help them overcome a sense of imposter syndrome that they may feel, especially in like predominantly white institutions?
Absolutely, I understand. No, I think to feel one with the world, you know, to fit in, I think you need to first believe in yourself. You are unique. You may look different, talk different, eat different, sound different, and do different things. But that itself makes you distinctive, just like the 8 billion people around you. So I would advise anyone who feels they're not fitting in that you need to beam in your uniqueness and know the irony that if all of us are unique, then aren't we all the same? Because we're all unique. That just binds us all together. You know, I've studied medicine and I know that we're the same flesh and blood. It's just that our color could vary. So when we believe in ourselves and feel connected with ourselves, I think that's a good way to become one with the world. So, you know, self-esteem, the word self-esteem comes from the self. It's not determined by what others think about you. So when we realize that's what self-esteem is, I think we'll be one with ourselves and be one with the world around us.
And my last question is about mental health stigma within AAPI and Asian communities. Where does it arise from? What are the dangers and how should we overcome it?
I think, you know, mental health stigma in the Asian American and the AAPI community is rooted in the fear of being thought of as weak or crazy. You know, it's basically shame and embarrassment that holds so many people from actually seeking professional help. They may speak to friends and family or even medical doctors when they have physical symptoms of anxiety. But I see that people who aren't so confident about themselves in the first place are the ones who get stressed and could lead to getting problems like anxiety and depression. But they don't end up seeing mental health professionals. So this is what delays the delivery of care. And that is when simpler issues like a little bit of stress and sadness may exacerbate into more serious issues like anxiety and depression. And that's what leads to isolation and in extreme cases, suicide. In fact, in my book, you know, which is just launched a week ago, it's called Why Do I Feel So Sad? It's dealing with everyday blues, everyday stresses, everyday sadness, and working on a way to prevent it from getting to full-blown depression. So I think we need to discuss these issues more every day at an early stage, let's say at school and college levels, to prime people about the normalcy of not feeling okay. You know, we have that pressure that we've always got to be okay. So what I want to say is it's okay to not be okay. You know, you need to establish a better awareness of how you're feeling and an acceptance to the guidance and coaching around which is available for you. So you have to build on your resilience to prevent problems in the first place, but also to know that there are accessible sources to seek help, which is what will help these problems get resolved seamlessly. So I would say mental health stigma is more of a personal internalized concept, which is called self-stigma. You know, again, I have this chapter in my book called Stigma, that you can't beat a problem without beating its stigma. The stigma is what creates half the problem because you're not seeking help, which is actually so easy to get. And it's so easy to resolve issues if you just looked at things differently, but then you need to speak to someone who can help you through it. So I think it's very important to speak up.
Yeah, that is great advice. And I believe that is all of our questions. So thank you to Dr. Batra so much for joining us. And I think this was a very great and productive conversation. And
thanks, Amy. It was just so good to be here and watch you both doing this. Your show is great. And I love listening to y'all and really proud of what you're doing here.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being here again.
And to our listeners, make sure to subscribe to Our Bodies, Our Stories, and tune in next time.